from KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. On air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Famuliner. Today we're hosting a special year-end episode of Intersection, where we'll recap some of the top stories we discussed on the show this year and hear from the newsmakers involved with those stories. Crime and public safety were on the minds of many Columbia residents this year following a series of high-profile shootings. That included the shooting death of slain teenager Travion Marshall, a homicide in a Conley Road shopping center in what's believed to be a drug deal gone bad, and shots fired in Columbia's downtown district in July. In response, Columbia Mayor Bob McDavid announced a six-point plan to tackle violent crime. Among the ideas, a 20-cent property tax increase to hire 35 additional officers. The mayor also announced the members of a task force charged with investigating Columbia's crime problem. The same day that Mayor McDavid announced those ideas in August, he was a guest on Intersection. In the following clip from that show, you'll also hear from Columbia Police Officers Association Executive Director Dale Roberts and Columbia City Council Member Laura Nauser.
In my view, in comparison to other comparable cities, you know, we have fewer police officers than, in my opinion, we should. I think people are rightly concerned about crime, and I think it's time to right-size our police department. The math is really pretty simple. I mean, you know, I'm told that the numbers represent about $100,000 for each police officer. By the time you count salary, benefits, retirement, and the equipment that the police officer has. So 35 was mentioned by police chief a couple of years ago, and I think the CPOA, Police Officers Association, I think the number you mentioned was 38.
Yes, sir.
But 20 cents would be a 3% increase in your property tax bill, 3%. And that would fund 35 police officers.
Right. And so what's the situation otherwise without that, without bringing in this new revenue?
Well, we'll get by. You know, as I've mentioned before, we have some financial headwinds that we've had to confront as a city, pension plans, the use of sales tax as a primary funding mechanism, which has a couple of major flaws in it. And, you know, another headwind is, frankly, we've made a commitment to fund social services. We've made a commitment to fund the arts. We've made a commitment to fund the CARE program. These are long-term commitments. I don't believe the city is in any position to back off on those commitments. I don't believe the city is in a position the citizens would want closing down the parks. So a revenue increase in view of these headwinds seems to me to be the only solution. About 6% of your personal property tax bill goes to the city. Most of it goes to Columbia Public Schools. Some of it goes to the county. Some of it goes to taxing districts like the library district. We get about $7 million a year from property tax. If we increased it 20 cents per $100 valuation, you know, it comes out to $3.5 million, 35 cops.
And so Dale Roberts with the Columbia Police Officers Association, I wonder, you've just got a few hours now that you've been hearing this news and trying to figure out what it might mean, but what's your initial reaction to this idea?
Our first reaction is, you know, we're overjoyed that the city let me back up and take it chronologically. I believe the chief asked for 35 officers maybe 2 years ago. It was our understanding that he asked for 38 officers this year. The CPOA came out about a week and a half ago and said, we support our chief 100% in the request of additional officers. And we're delighted that the city has joined in the idea that we need more feet on the street. So we're delighted to hear it. It's good news. It's nice when the officers and the administration all agree on something. I will say last year, the officers came forward and voluntarily surrendered some of their retirement benefits, took reduced benefits, extended the time an officer has to work before he or she gets retirement. And I think that was about a $43 million benefit to the city. So the officers have made some sacrifice, and now we're asking citizens one way or another to do likewise and support the department.
And why, just to take a step back, why have we gotten to this point where we don't have the amount of officers? I mean, it seems like everyone at the table seems to agree we don't have the level of officers we'd like to have in the city. Why, how have we gotten to this point?
If I don't do maintenance on my car every year, eventually I'm going to have a big repair bill because I wasn't doing the necessary upkeep, oil change, what have you. And it's the same way with the public department. If you don't add a few officers every year and keep up with growth, one day you're going to find, holy cow, we have allowed ourselves to fall this far behind, and now it's going to cost us more.
The Columbia Police Officers Association later criticized Mayor McDavid's income tax proposal on the grounds that there was enough money in the city's budget to hire additional officers. Shortly after, Mayor McDavid scrapped the proposal. A few weeks later, in August, we invited City Manager Mike Mathis on the show to discuss his proposed 2014 city budget, which included funding to hire 3 additional police officers, well below CPOA's recommendation of 38 new officers. I asked him if that was enough and about the likelihood of hiring more officers in the future.
It's all we can do with the resources we have. Moving forward, barring any future recessions, so we know that won't be forever, but we can do 1 or 2 added positions each year is a reasonable, rational expectation. And that's because over time, sales tax revenue does increase. Now, the funny thing is it's increased at a much slower rate than it has in the past, and so we can get into what Amazon's doing to our revenue. So there is more money there, but it's not a huge amount. So the most we can do is have 1 or 2 added positions each year. This year we're able to do 3 because of the 911 tax passing. But you look at that in context, to compare our staffing levels to any city our size with a university our size in the country, and we are lower. We're 30% smaller than other cities our size. So is the university's police department. So many people say, well, you know, you have to add them to be apples to apples. That comparison's the same if you add them. We're still together 30% smaller than the equivalent in other cities. So that's why that 35 number, 38 number, depends on how many you're trying to get to. But if you get to average, you need at least 30 officers to get there.
Okay. And at the work session over the weekend, there was a work session where city council and some leaders looked over this budget. I think I read you were quoted as saying, if we were going to try to add new officers now, we would need some new revenue. So
yes.
Were you talking about anything in particular there when you said new revenue? What could you see as possibilities for this?
Well, my point is you can't get 30 officers in the current budget. You know, the vast majority of our general fund dollars are already committed to public safety. There's not enough money there to fund 30 more officers. So you have to get a new source of revenue in some way, whether that's a property tax or a sales tax or something else. If you don't want to pay more, we can approach it with, we'll just see how many we can squeeze into the budget each year. And there is growth, and so you can do 1 or 2, maybe 3 a year.
Okay.
So a 10-year plan would get us there, or raise the tax now.
Okay. I mentioned earlier in the show that we curated some questions from some of our past guests, and I wanted to bring one of those questions in here. Brent Gardner is a Columbia real estate agent and chairman of the Downtown Columbia Leadership Council. He asked, do you think there's a connection between Columbia's increase of students living downtown and the recent wave of late-night violence downtown?
No. That's the short answer. The long answer, you know, that's something I've heard, you know, kind of kicked around. And I say no because of the details of the crimes that have happened. If you look at the folks that are involved in those crimes, they're not college students.
Okay. What do you think, too, though, about that is a new reality downtown where we have those college students? What do you think about the clash between, I don't want to say clash, but the fact that that population, in some ways the lifeblood of this town, is now close to some of this, these violent acts, and that, you know, what does that say for the city going forward?
Sure. Good question. You know, the interesting thing is, big picture, nationwide, statistical level, presence of law-abiding folks pushes away crime. So the best way, for example, to take back a park or a neighborhood is to have everybody go out of their house, you know, and be out there. It's interesting how criminals don't, they want to be very isolated and alone and in the dark. And so having folks living downtown is one of the best things we can do to lower crime rate downtown. Now, that said, it's still a worry, and we still have crime downtown. There's no question. It's a lot lower than people think, which, you know, I can tell you the statistics and tell you that you're half as likely to be a victim of crime in Columbia as you were 10 years ago. it doesn't make you feel better when there's a shooting at 10th and Broadway, right? Mm. So we have to deal with both how it feels, how we all feel about crime, and then the reality of it. So for us to do that, we really dig in on each individual crime. And I just got to take a moment and really praise the police department, our detectives division, our vice narcotics division. The whole department's done a great job. At this point, all the bad guys from this last summer have been caught and apprehended. So they're doing a great job. And that's because, you know, they dig in and do the hard day-to-day work of the police department.
Sure. And I'll go back to when the mayor introduced that proposal for the property tax. He mentioned, I'm not sure why, but he went ahead and spelled out the power structure at the city and pointed out that you are the person that oversees mm-hmm. directly Chief Ken Burton. I wonder, because there's been a lot of discussion about this, CPOA and others have been vocal about their lack of confidence in Chief Ken Burton. I wonder where you are on that. Are you confident in him at this moment?
I'm 100% confident in Chief Burton. He does a great job with an incredible amount of insubordination from CPOA and others. Our system allows for insubordination, unfortunately. You know, you think about other systems like the county government, the sheriff, where 100% of their employees are at will. You better not pull that kind of stuff there, right? And most people wouldn't allow their own businesses to be run the way we must and with our current approach. So, you know, it's unfortunate. For many other reasons, this group has decided to take some tactics that have really never worked in our history in America, but they really believe in it. Kind of old school. You think of these when you think of old school unions, you know, kind of smear campaigns and things like that. So, you know, to dig into it, I talk to everyone, and you know, you reference, you know, kind of the things you hear, mm-hmm. the rumor mill, and I would always follow up. What do you mean? You know, what makes you not have confidence? How is it that this chief is so bad, you know, what you end up with are very petty things. One example, a recent retiree is still extremely mad that we deleted take-home vehicles. He had to buy a car for the first time in his life. So those are the sources of a lot of it. A lot of it, quite honestly, is this chief has done exactly what he's been asked to do, come in and modernize this department. We have a lot of very talented, very dedicated folks, but our processes, our policies were very old-fashioned. So a good example is our property room. This is something that went public last year, I think. The chief came in and did an audit of how we deal with things that we seize at crime scenes and others, and it was incredibly sloppy. And so best practice is much different than our practice was. Mm-hmm. So the chief changed our way of doing business. That was unpopular with some, and I will say very small number, but they are vocal, those changes. Most officers realize, hey, this is a good change, and we're into it.
This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Femuehlener. Today on the program, we're hosting a special year-end episode of Intersection where we're recapping some of the top stories we talked about on the show this year. Intersection's a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. This week's show's not live, but we'd like to remind you, you can usually watch Intersection as streaming video online during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2 at kbia.org. You can watch that video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. One story that got a lot of national attention this year happened at the Missouri State Fair in Sedalia in August. A rodeo clown wearing a President Obama mask mocked the president during a live show, sparking controversy as word spread about the spectacle. Video of the now infamous incident show many in the crowd cheering as an announcer asks whether they want to see a bull run the clown over. Photos and reports of the event went viral, prompting criticism from many Missourians and politicians, with some calling it racist. We visited Sedalia a few days after the stunt for a live show we actually had planned even before the rodeo clown incident happened. I spoke to the fair director, Mark Wolf. In this clip, you'll hear Wolf refer to the MRCA several times. He's referring to the Missouri Rodeo Cowboy Association.
On behalf of myself and the State Fair Commission and our entire staff and the Missouri Department of Agriculture, you know, we apologize to everyone, including our president, over what occurred over there. It is certainly not something that's condoned by the State Fair. It is not what the State Fair is about. And I just can't express the disappointment we have that that occurred over there, and we just want to apologize to folks.
And maybe you could help us understand too, I guess, how that could have happened. I guess the fact maybe people don't even know necessarily what the Rodeo Clown's role is there in some of these performances, but how, what's the chain of command there, and who would have known about this before it had happened?
Well, we're still investigating a little bit about the incident. Obviously, the clown himself may be the second one that was involved. Obviously, this was not a planned event, evidently, as far as the MRCA was concerned. It's their show. We pay them in a contracted form to put on that rodeo event. Obviously, the clown in a rodeo event is part of the entertainment. Supposed to be, and it's supposed to be comical, and but it's supposed to be family oriented, and in this instance, it appears that the lead clown out on the ground or out on the arena floor, maybe the announcer involved, as we're still investigating that. There was some banter that got going on this, and then of all things, for the crowd to sit there and cheer on something like that is very disappointing also. So it's happened. Nothing we can do about that at this point other than apologize to folks and make sure it's not going to happen again. Mm-hmm. I let those folks know immediately that morning. Those members of their crew were not to be back on this fairgrounds permanently for any reason. And as we check into this farther, anybody else that we find that was involved in that will be treated likewise. We will certainly be reviewing any kind of opportunity to contract again with the MRCA. I will tell you, they've been a longtime partner out here. I think they're a fine organization, have always done a great job, and I know for a fact that their board is extremely upset by what occurred, and I do believe it was contained to two or three individuals that decided they thought that something like that would be funny.
And so it is a contracted event, so ultimately that's about all the State Fair can do, I suppose. So, but then you know anything of possible ramifications?
Well, I would assume that the MRCA will definitely deal with their own in this case. Beyond us saying you're not allowed to use them back out here in our facility under, whether it's that organization or another rodeo company, those individuals are banned in terms of performing on our fairgrounds. And as we find out more, there could be other penalties brought. And, but I would certainly believe that the folks from MRCA will address this very firmly and very matter-of-factly. And I would assume those people probably won't be a part of that organization.
Mm-hmm. In the aftermath of this event and things getting posted online, many people were weighing in, Missouri politicians, Missourians, about their unhappiness with the situation. Some politicians were actually calling for the state to look at the funding they provide to the State Fair. I don't know if you've seen those claims yet, and saying that the state should be looking at that. What's your response to that as far as this event having those sort of possible ramifications?
Well, I believe first and foremost, I hate to see agriculture and what the fair is all about and the history of this fair and the kids that we're supporting out here and the good side of the fair be penalized as a whole because of the actions of one. Obviously, this was an atrocious act, and I wish we could have been there and got it stopped. But it's one of those things that, you're always at risk, and it's not just here at the fair. It's at any other venue anywhere in the world, when somebody has a microphone. And they're expected to be professionals and do a professional job at something, there has to be a certain amount of trust that they will do that. And in this case, obviously this gentleman that was the clown that night and maybe some co-conspirators in this issue took advantage of that. And, by the time they went out and started doing it, obviously the damage is being done. I have heard that it may have gone on as long as 15 minutes, and that really disturbs me. I don't know what our folks were thinking over there, or their folks, I should say. They're in control of that. But obviously I would think that the announcer in the stand would have probably had an opportunity to turn that off or stop that. Did not happen. So, the penalty phase of what happened as far as those folks are concerned is not done. And we will certainly be reviewing whether or not we will be looking at moving forward with any kind of contract in the future with those folks until we have some things decided and reviewed.
Yeah, and for that matter, what else may this change about the way you guys handle performers in the future? I know it's early on to think about that, but...
Well, I can tell you that just through the conversation this morning, as we've continued to deal with this, and, obviously we want to reply to people, and we are obviously being overwhelmed here at the fair, myself and our staff and everybody here from across the country with some fairly scathing probably not appropriate remarks our direction over this event also. And, you know, that's a little tough to take. Obviously, this is not something we planned and certainly don't condone. And we're doing everything that we can to correct this issue as best we can. And beyond that, you know, we our sincere apologies to certainly the President of the United States and everyone that was offended by it, because we're offended by it. And, you know, so moving forward, we're looking at contract changes for all our contracts. It will include required sensitivity training and some things like that. State employees have to do that. I see no reason why some of our contractors may not have to follow those same guidelines, and maybe these folks need a little training about how to act out in public. Hmm.
And I'm not hearing from you some comments. There's been a lot of comments about this, but some comments are saying, hey, people poke fun at presidents and politicians all the time. I'm not hearing that from you.
You know, I think that's inappropriate in any situation. You know, there's something that goes along with being the president of the United States that I think we're, you know, whether you agree with the politics of the sitting president or not, that requires a certain amount of respect. And I think to do something like what happened over there the other night is extremely disrespectful. And, you know, the consequences for that, I'm sure, are going to be long and lasting with the gentleman that was involved.
Some of the people that have been commenting about this, and well, including state legislators, have also referred to this as a racist incident. I wanted to see what your thoughts are. I know you're still trying to figure out exactly what happened, but your thoughts on that accusation, and again, how that may affect what's going forward here.
Well, you know, I believe it is a little bit of a racial issue, you know, a racist issue when you do something like that. You know, I've heard all the comments and, you know, well, if it had been, you know, this president or that president, but I feel like the level of disrespect is the same regardless. And, you know, I, in my mind, we're not going to differentiate on our behalf one way or another. It was an inappropriate act, an unconscionable stunt. I just can't fathom what was going on in these folks' head to pull something like that.
There haven't been any measures yet to actually pull funding from the fair due to the incident. The rodeo clown, Tuffy Gessling, was banned from the fair and stopped performing for a while, but did reemerge at a rodeo in Jefferson City later in the year. Another big but very local story this year involves significant change in leadership at the University of Missouri. After leading the University of Missouri's flagship campus for nearly a decade, Chancellor Brady Deaton and Provost Brian Foster announced their retirements, with two other top administrators also announcing their retirements shortly after Deaton's. I invited Deaton and Foster to our studio back in October, and we asked Provost Foster what advice he'd give to his successor.
I think you could really overestimate the amount of change that we're going to see. This is a very large, robust organization with enormous amount of momentum moving forward. And the momentum comes from high-quality people, high-quality programs. And I don't think, even if somebody came in and wanted to make fundamental, big, rapid changes, I don't think they could, number one. But number two, I don't think they'd want to, because this is a wonderful place. So I don't find that to be a big concern.
It's the strength of the faculty and the organizational processes in the university and the structures there with the deans and chairs that keep the university going.
Right.
And that's why you can make changes at the top without much fear of losing the real strength that you have as a university. Every generation of leaders have certain imprints that they will work toward and lead toward change that hopefully gets it better and better all the time. That's what we want for our successors. And I have no doubt that there will be effective leadership continuing, and we'll see things just continue to prosper for the university.
One thing I'm going to throw out there, because, again, I work on campus, and I think because it's been such a big shift naturally, I think there's some speculation. And the speculation I have heard from some is that some or all of you may have been forced out, something like that. What would you say to that type of speculation? You've already talked a little bit, Chancellor Deaton, about your motivations for retiring.
Well, I'd say if that were the case, we've not felt it, let me say.
Okay.
No, these are very natural processes of change that are underway here, and us looking at our professional and personal lives generally.
I think you have four people leaving for four very different kinds of reasons that just happened to come together at the same time. I don't see any common dynamic.
Right,
it wasn't
planned at all.
In
fact, we were sort of surprised ourselves as it evolved. But it was just the nature of we've had a team that certainly worked very closely and well together, but in different ways, and that team continues. Whether that person, as Provost said earlier, whether that person is carrying it out or someone that was working in the organization now is in the interim position pushing it, and new leadership will come in and the organization will continue to go forward.
Okay. Well, moving on again, we actually did get a question, despite the fact that we aren't live this week. We put out a call to some of our former guests to ask if they had questions. And Mary Beck, who is actually a law professor here at the university, sent us a question asking why you both stayed on so long at the university. Past retirement age, what made you stay here this long?
Well, first let me say, I'm not sure what retirement age is anymore. last week I was in a conversation with a lawyer in Houston, and I said something about the 70s as maybe a time to think about things a little differently. He was very surprised. Of course, I was talking to a peer age-wise. He was like, well, so what's new about that? You know, my gosh, we're all charging away. For me, I had, there were family aspects of my family I wanted to spend more time on. There were aspects of my appointed role on BIFAD, Board for International Food and Ag Development, I wanted to spend more time on. Then I wanted to focus on fewer items and do less of the day-to-day administrative work, quite honestly. So it just came for me. It came very naturally at a point where I just wanted to do things a bit differently.
I came to higher ed as a first-generation student, and my dad quit school in seventh grade. I went to undergraduate school in my late 20s. I had no idea what higher ed meant, really, and it opened up a life for me that I could never have imagined. I'm really passionate about it. So why did I stay on? It's something I'm passionate about, mm-hmm. and I really want to try to make a difference, and it's satisfying to me. And right. So all of that together yeah. is it was not a hard decision to stay sure. on.
I would add the thought of staying on, yeah. as I say, yeah. was I never thought yeah. of it as staying on. I was just yeah. doing what came yeah. naturally. And I had a similar background, and neither of my parents, my father went through high school, my mother eighth grade, and no one in our family had gone on to university. Mm-hmm. And so this was a new experience. And as Brian said, it opened up a whole world. Very exciting, very stimulating. And I think both Brian and I are as stimulated today as we were when we started this process. It's right. a very exciting process.
Earlier this month, the university announced Deaton's replacement, former president of the University of Texas A&M, Bowen Lofton. Lofton will start at MU on February 1st. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today, we're hosting a special year-end episode of Intersection, where we're recapping some of the top stories we talked about on the show this year. I'm Ryan Femuliner, and we'll be right back after a short break. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Femuliner. Today we're hosting a special year-end episode of Intersection where we're recapping some of the top stories we talked about on the show this year. As always, it was a busy year in the state legislature and an interesting one politically this year. Republicans controlled a rare veto-proof majority in both the state House and Senate, pitted against a Democratic governor. In his State of the State address in January, Governor Jay Nixon made expanding Medicaid one of his main issues for the legislative session, but that never got traction. Republican leadership did spend a lot of time creating an income tax cut and gun control issues. Right after the legislative session ended, Republican Senator Kurt Schaefer, Republican House Member Kayleigh Browden, and Democratic House Member Chris Kelly joined us on Intersection to debrief, and Browden talked about one of the things he was proud of about the session.
You know, one of the big things that we were celebrating in the House that made it to the governor's desk was the first income tax reform in 100 years or so in the state of Missouri, an income tax cut that will take the personal income tax rate from 6% to 5.5% over the course of 10 years, I think, and then it'll cut corporate income tax in half over that same period. There's triggers built in there that will make it to where there has to be a certain amount of revenue growth the year prior for the cut the next year to come to fruition. So I think it's a good measured response to some of the stuff that's going on around us, and I hope it's something that the governor will sign. I hope it's something that will allow for an infusion of new dollars in the private sector, and hopefully just continue to allow the economy in Missouri to grow. It was a good year for revenues in the state legislature, and hopefully we can continue to see that trend move upward.
And you kind of got to the main question there is, will the governor sign that? I guess I wonder what Senator Schaefer or Representative Kelly, what you think of that?
On the tax cut legislation?
Yes.
I think he's already sent some pretty strong signals that he will not sign that.
Right. So, I don't know.
I think he will veto it, and I think he should veto it. It is very, very bad public policy. The net effect will be that it will take money out of education and transfer it to only, almost exclusively, to incredibly wealthy people who are the people for whom we did it. But there's no question that it's a transfer from elementary and secondary and higher education into the pockets of very wealthy supporters of the legislation.
Senator Kurt Schaefer explained one situation that caused a controversy during the legislative session surrounding information about concealed carry license holders in Missouri that was provided to the federal government.
I started looking into that, I guess it was end of February or so, when the Columbia Fee Office changed over, and I got calls from several constituents the very first day the Columbia Fee Office changed over, and they said, we're having to bring these documents in to get a driver's license renewed or a non-driver's license, which is what most people have their concealed carry permit on. Additional documents, mortgage documents, birth certificates, marriage licenses, divorce papers, and those documents were being scanned and kept by the Department of Revenue, which most people recognize was a substantial change of policy, and something that alarmed a lot of people. So we brought in the Department of Revenue, and after basically extracting a lot of teeth for a couple weeks, found out that they're essentially implementing a federal law called Real ID, which requires essentially that you build a file on everyone who has a driver's license. It includes a lot of personal documents, which are then subject, frankly, to being compromised if somebody gets into the website for the Department of Revenue or their database. So identity theft is an issue. Also, the concept that as part of this file, there's a high-resolution picture taken of you, and then they take the biometrics of your face, the distance between your ears and your eyes and all those things. And then that's kept and on a daily basis. It is run against everyone else who applies for a driver's license, as well as apparently some other uses too. And a lot of people, me included, have an issue with that. It really leads to this issue that we've got technology developing at a very fast pace, especially with the war on terror. A lot of things developed in the Middle East that are now coming back to what is a free society. And really, what are you giving up? What privacy are you giving up just to get a driver's license? And so that debate started. And so the question of, how is the integrity of this information protected led us down a road to find out that, in fact, that the concealed carry list, which at the time was over 160,000 Missourians, now it's over 180,000 just in that short time frame. But that is by law protected in the state of Missouri. It's not to be disclosed. And in fact, the state did produce that entire list to at least one federal agency who was doing arguably some peripheral investigation that really didn't seem very related to that issue to me. But this idea of privacy, collecting information as the Department of Revenue is doing in a way that Missourians really weren't even aware of, because we have a law in the state of Missouri when an agency is going to make a change like this, they have to promulgate a rule and tell the public, and the media picks up on that because it gets posted in the state register. And that was never done to this day, still not done with that process. But this idea of gathering more private information on people, really not so much for law enforcement but for intelligence gathering. And it really is a serious question. And I think we were at the forefront of that issue a couple months in the state of Missouri. But now you see what's coming out of Washington, D.C. with the IRS and some other state agent or federal agencies really doing the same thing, kind of taking the next step in private information gathering, almost like intelligence gathering. And it's very troubling. And I think that my biggest concern here is we need to have a public policy debate on the Senate floor, and the governor, who refuses to get engaged in this debate, even though he's the one doing it, he needs to very publicly engage in a debate of why he thinks this is appropriate, where the lines are of what is too much, and where we want to go as a state. And we still haven't done that, and I'm not going to be comfortable until we have that debate and decide both as a legislature and as a state of Missouri where we want to go in that regard.
Representative Kelly, I wanted to get your thoughts on this whole scenario.
In 2011, I sponsored a bill to make this information all private. The bill went nowhere. This year, I sponsored the same bill to make all this information private. The bill went nowhere. The reason the bill is not going anywhere is because this is such a fascinating political tool to beat up the governor. If we were serious about the problem, the legislature created the problem by passing laws which allow it to happen. Nothing happened that was illegal. The government had the right to do what it did. I wish the government didn't have the right to do that and have offered legislation to stop it. But the legislature, instead of passing the law to change it, chose instead to yammer on endlessly about how bad Nixon is. If you don't like it, fix the problem that we created. That's why I'm extremely skeptical about the commitment to this whole issue. If you're serious about it, change the law.
The scrutiny did lead to some changes. Governor Nixon ordered that the Missouri Department of Revenue cease scanning source documents for concealed carry weapons applicants, and the department director, Brian Long, resigned. The legislature also passed a number of other gun-related bills, including one, House Bill 436, that would have made it illegal to enforce federal gun laws in Missouri. We asked Democratic Representative Chris Kelly his thoughts on those types of measures.
The constitutionality of 436 is not in doubt. It is a matter of absolute lead pipe certainty that it will be declared unconstitutional. There is a 200-year tradition in the United States Supreme Court of finding that states do not have the power to set aside federal law. And that's what it did. It was a direct expression of contempt for the Constitution of the United States. I understand why it was done. Make sure the constituents knew how terribly involved we are in protecting the Second Amendment. I don't think that is license to trample on the Constitution. And no prosecutor will allow police in his county to enforce it. No judge will sustain it. It is never, ever going to be law. And to pass it is, I believe, an extremely irresponsible act without regard to what you think about the Second Amendment. The reason the Second Amendment is important is because it's in the Constitution. That's not an excuse to trample on the rest of the document.
What about the focus and the other legislation that came through on gun control this session as well? What are your thoughts on
that? There was some okay legislation. There was some stupid legislation for both sides. See, people on both sides of this tend to turn off their intellectual capacity when it comes to the issue. Sometimes liberals talk about assault weapons when an assault weapon is essentially a characterization of the appearance of the weapon rather than what it will do. And they don't get any further than the term assault weapon. On the other hand, some right-wingers look at any bill that has the word gun in it and think it must be okay. This bill was not supported by the NRA. Now think for a moment what it means when you have gun law that's too crazy for the NRA.
Governor Nixon vetoed that House Bill 436 and the bill mentioned earlier that would have created an income tax cut. But because of that veto-proof majority, Republican legislators had a good chance to be able to pass these laws anyway if they could all vote together to override the veto at the veto session in September. Governor Nixon spent a lot of time in the months leading up to the veto session campaigning against the effort to override his veto. Republicans failed to get everyone on board. And while they did override a record number of vetoes, they did not override the crown jewel, the income tax, which was House Bill 253. The House sponsor, Republican T.J. Barry, joined us on the show a few days after the veto session ended and talked through the issue with Democratic Representative Chris Kelly. T.J. Barry, we have you here, the House sponsor of that bill. So why don't we just jump right in? Why weren't Republicans able to muster up enough votes to get that passed, overridden rather?
Well, you could answer that two ways. One, we did not have the will to override the governor. Or two, the governor did a very good job of explaining a few of the problems that were unintended of 253 and that doubt led to the veto being upheld.
Right. And some of those, the governor pushed some issues on things, the way the bill was written, right? There was some language that appeared to probably be accidental, maybe, at least that's the way it was discussed later. Would you have changed much about how it was written?
Sure. I mean, the three things that the governor really pointed out this summer were the prescription drug portion of this, which was unintended and was a drafting error. Then there was the textbook issue. And then finally, the retroactivity. Those are the three points that he really hammered home My argument would be if I fix those 3 points and put that exact same bill in front of the governor, I think that the outcome would be the same. He would veto it. And we failed this summer to have a true discussion about economic development and how we're going to go about doing that.
Right. Representative Kelly, I know you came out strongly against this bill, too, during the veto session as well. Was it because of, as Representative Barry's talking about, because of those errors, or was it the larger idea, or a little bit of both?
Certainly both. It was my job to shepherd the opposition to the bill on the House floor. I was very unhappy as a 17-year veteran of the legislature with the quality of the legislation. There was a lot of mistakes in it and a lot of expensive mistakes. The retroactivity issue that TJ pointed to is alone perhaps as much as $1 billion. I don't think you can go out there with tax legislation with billion-dollar errors in it and expect a different result, or at least I hope that you wouldn't get a different result. I hope that legislators would defeat any tax bill with $1 billion error.
Representative Barry, can you comment on that?
Sure. From my perspective and when we drafted it, we looked at precedents. And precedents says that tax bills start taking effect going forward from the time that they are passed. So I assumed that that rule would hold true with this tax bill. The governor and the attorney general both disagree because of the unique nature of the marketplace fairness portion of this bill. And so when you're dealing with something new and you're relying on precedents, maybe there was some room for discussion and room to make it better going forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you mentioned, the larger issue here, of course, are those tax cuts. And so do you expect to see, or are you going to be part of something that's going to come up next session? I mean, obviously, this is not a discussion that's going to go away just because this bill was shot down.
I will absolutely be involved in creating other tax cut bills, and I would imagine that the governor will see several. And I would be very surprised if he does not see one in the first month and a half of the session.
So on that discussion, like you said, that you feel like we didn't get this time around, what should we be talking about? What is the discussion about economic reform and that?
Every time, no matter if it's a Democratic bill, Republican bill, whatever the bill, I think that we should always start with the idea of what problem are you trying to address with that language? And the problem that I'm trying to address with tax reform is twofold. One, it hasn't been reformed in almost 100 years. And two, we have to create jobs in the state of Missouri. And how are we going to go about doing that? There are two schools of thought. You can attract businesses into the state and have a really aggressive method to do that, or you can grow the businesses that are here. And I believe that companies that grow here in Missouri are invested, their owners are parts of the community, and their likelihood of leaving is much, much smaller than a company that has been attracted to the state with dollars. The dollars then run out, and then they are saying, what are you going to give me now, or I'm going to move to the next state that gives me money.
Okay. Representative Kelly, what's your reaction to that, the idea that we need to have these economic incentives, and would it be something that you might support ever?
I think that I was in fact part of an effort to pass a $200 million tax decrease that Representative Funderburk and I did on the Marketplace Fairness Bill. The irony of this whole thing is we could have gotten a $200 million tax decrease instead of not getting an $800 million tax decrease. When you go to the extreme, here's where you always end up. The moderate middle of this society has a way of dealing with extremes. This bill was way too extreme and therefore ultimately doesn't make it.
Again, that was Democratic State Representative Chris Kelly talking with Republican State Representative TJ Barry. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're hosting a special year-end episode of Intersection where we're recapping some of the top stories we talked about on the show this year. So while we just spent a lot of time talking about how much legislators and the governor fought over strategies to attract new businesses, both sides came together in that exact effort earlier this month. Governor Nixon called a special session, and Missouri lawmakers approved a package of tax credits aimed at attracting a new Boeing facility to the state.
Missouri is one of about 15 states competing to house the new production site of Boeing's 777X airliner. Missouri's bid offers the company up to $1.7 billion over 23 years, with the exact amount depending on the number of jobs created. The state's also offering assistance with job training and a pledge from union groups to work around the clock without overtime to build the facility as quickly as possible. The company's expected to announce a decision early next year. A few weeks ago, we took a closer look at Missouri's offer and talked about ways the state could best attract businesses in the future. I spoke to MU Public Affairs Professor Brian Dabson, Democratic State Representative Chris Kelly, and Daniel Meehan. He's the president and CEO of the Missouri Chamber of Commerce and Industry. I started by asking Dabson if corporations now hold more negotiating power than states.
Boeing is a very interesting case because it has become very experienced in extracting large amounts of money from state governments and elsewhere. If you just go back 10 years to 2001, when they wanted to relocate their headquarters from Seattle, they invited bids from Chicago and Dallas and Denver. And in the end, Chicago ended up paying $55 million to attract 500 jobs. Mm-hmm. They did it again with the Dreamliner. In I think it was 2003, they got $3.2 billion out of the state of Washington to build the Dreamliner. And then in 2009, they pushed out some of the production to South Carolina. And South Carolina gave them $900 million. So we're now in a pattern that every time they have a new plane, a new piece of development, they put it out to bid. And this time it's 12 to 15 states. But the real act to beat, as far as Missouri is concerned, is Washington's own bid. And mm-hmm. they've put in, I'm trying to remember the amount that they've put in. It's about $3.4 billion that they're now offering to keep them in Washington. Mm-hmm. So no corporation worth its salt is going to go about a development project without first seeing what it can get from the state that it wishes to locate in.
Is Boeing just more adept at this than other companies, or other companies use the same moves?
Other companies do it all the time, yeah. But Boeing is one of the stars in this in terms of the sheer scale of money they've managed to pull from different states. Mm-hmm. And the CEO argues that basically this is a way of reducing the cost of business.
It's pretty much supply and demand. If you look at the demand for the state is getting those high-quality jobs, 2,000 to 8,000, depending on how this project is scaled. And if you look at the competition out there, Boeing's a unique case, not necessarily for the commercial side, but for the military aircraft side. But we're competing with other states, other countries. We're competing with Singapore, Ireland, Germany, you name it, for these opportunities. And like Brian said, companies are getting fairly good at this. They know what's at stake. And they know they can leverage a deal to make it as competitive as possible to locate in a state or a country wherever they can go. Mm-hmm. The states that will do this will win. We're one of 12 to 15 states. And, Chris, I don't know, I've rarely do you see a company come to the legislature and ask for an incentive like the Ford bill or like others that we've seen, Wholesome Cement, for example. Boeing didn't show up. They simply put the RFP out. Their lobbyists weren't even in the hearing rooms, but it's that valuable that it coalesced St. Louis City, St. Louis County, the state of Missouri, business, labor, you name it, all together. And the magnitude and scale of that was something that needs to be reckoned with.
Sure. And just for our audience, we're going to mention RFP a lot throughout the day. It's a request for proposals put out. But I guess, Dan, maybe get your thoughts on the plan that did pass. Again, the governor hasn't quite signed it yet, but Missouri's incentive plan. What are your thoughts on that and its chances, I guess?
I think we'll get a piece of the pie. I'm not sure how big it will be or small it will be compared to the pie. But if you look at what Boeing likes to do, they like to spread their facilities out into as many congressional districts that they can get in, because their main customer is the Department of Defense, and they need to have a big footprint to make sure they have sway to compete with other aerospace giants and military competition. So I think we get something out of this. St. Louis has a very skilled workforce with the legacy from McDonnell Douglas, then Boeing, with the fighter aircraft and the other aerospace industries that Boeing has there on the facility. And if you look at what's happening on the military side, which is what St. Louis is, the production of the F-18 is going to slow down, and someday it's going to end. And they've got that facility. More importantly, they got the talent there. And so I think St. Louis is in a very competitive position.
It's important to recognize that one of the things in the governor's proposal is that Boeing will only get subsidies tied to the people that actually go to work. So they don't get – if they bring a piece of the action, they get only the amount of money that is attachable to those employees who actually produce – are on the payroll in Missouri. So it's tailored very specifically to how many people go to work.
Yeah, that $1.7 billion number is tied to, what, 8,000-something jobs, I think, mm-hmm. right?
That's the full deal. It's $150 million a year, and that's at full scale. But like Chris is saying, it's a scalable project. Mm-hmm. So if we get 2,000, it's based on that number. But it's all performance-based. They have got to put up the capital investment and the investment in jobs and create the jobs before they get an incentive. Another thing that's important is these aren't new programs. These are existing programs at the Department of Economic Development that we're simply saying raise the cap to a level to accommodate what could be 8,000 new jobs in the whole project. But it's pegged at wherever, however many jobs we get.
Again, Boeing is expected to announce the location it will choose for the 777X airliner production at the beginning of next year. Finally, a story that's been one of the most followed in Columbia for more than a decade took a major turn last month. A Missouri Court of Appeals vacated the conviction of Ryan Ferguson. You might recall Ferguson as one of the two men accused in the 2001 murder of Columbia Daily Tribune sports editor Kent Heitholt. In its legal opinion, the appeals court that vacated the conviction said the prosecution committed a Brady violation. That is, they violated Ferguson's due process rights by withholding favorable information from his defense team. Shortly after his conviction was vacated, Ryan was released from prison. Scores of people packed into the Tiger Hotel for a press conference with Ryan and family just hours after he was released.
I feel like Jay Leno or something. Steps back, people start clapping again. A lot of emotions. It's been long, and I'm glad that the difficult part is over for sure.
It still wasn't clear when Ryan would be released or if the state might even retry him for the murder. Ryan's father, Bill Ferguson, was on Intersection that day, along with former Boone County Assistant Prosecuting Attorney John Roodhouse and MU Law Professor Rodney Uphoff. Bill Ferguson started with his reaction to Ryan's vacated sentence, again, about 36 hours before his son would be released after almost a decade in prison.
Well, my immediate reaction is what took so long. It's taken a decade for something that the case had no merit, as far as we're concerned, initially. And it's taken 9.5 years and numerous appeals just to get to this stage. And to have the sentence vacated is exhilarating, to say the least. So we're very happy.
We've, again, got a variety of legal experts here as well. For those of you that have read, been following this case, what are your initial reactions to what the court put out, this appeals court last week, and what it said and what, I guess, what it means going forward, too?
Well, I think I should say from the outset that I haven't really followed this case very closely, and this occurred at a time before I worked at the Boone County Prosecutor's Office. So I don't have any inside information for you, unfortunately.
Sure.
But I think in reading the opinion, I think what concerns me is not necessarily the result that was reached. And again, I don't know enough about the case to comment as to whether or not the conviction should have been vacated or not. But I think having worked in a prosecutor's office, having worked with the attorney general, and seeing some of the language that was included in that opinion, I'm very concerned about what that can mean going forward for the administration of some of these law offices.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, Rodney, too, could you help us a little bit on the process going forward as well? We talked a little bit about that with Bill here, but.
Well, specifically, I guess what John's referring to is the question of Brady and a Brady violation here. And so the opinion is critical of the then district attorney, Mr. Crane, who is now a circuit court judge. But the opinion states very clearly that it felt that this was important exculpatory material that should have been turned over as both a statutory and constitutional matter, and its failure to do so, in the court's view, undermined the court's confidence in the verdict.
because if you look at the opinion, there were really two key witnesses who testified against Ryan Ferguson. The first was Chuck Erickson, the co-defendant. So his testimony was essentially a confession and said, I was involved and Ryan Ferguson was with me. So that was the linchpin of the state's case. But the corroborating witness was the janitor, who essentially said when he came out of the building, he saw two people in the alley. When he first he said, I saw these two people, but I didn't know who they were. Then his explanation for why it was that he suddenly was able to tell that it was Ryan Ferguson, Chuck Erickson, was he contended that he got a newspaper article while he was in prison. It was folded in a particular way, so he saw the pictures, but there were no names. And as soon as he saw the pictures, he testified at trial, he recognized the two people as the two people were in the alley. And it was only when he unfolded the newspaper did he then claim that he saw that it was Chuck Erickson and Ryan Ferguson, the names connected with the photo. Well, as the opinion lays out, the prosecutor sent one of his investigators out to speak with the wife of Jerry Trump, who was this witness. He sent his investigator out to speak to Barbara Trump. And Barbara Trump was asked about sending the newspaper article, and she said, I have no recollection of sending a newspaper article to Jerry Trump. So the investigator should have prepared a report, provided this information to the prosecutor, who in turn, under a case called Brady versus Maryland, this is classic exculpatory material, this material should have been turned over to the defense. Mm. Had it been turned over to the defense, they would have cross-examined Mr. Trump and may well have been able to discredit his testimony. So that's why the court ultimately concluded we're uncomfortable with the final result, because if you strip away Trump's evidence, that leaves only Chuck Erickson's testimony. The court did not say necessarily that it felt, in fact, it did not address the actual innocence claim, but it said, given the Brady violation, we're satisfied that we are not confident in the verdict, and therefore it overturned the conviction. So I think the larger problem identified here is one of the extent to which prosecutors are, in fact, complying with their obligation under Brady to turn over all exculpatory material. I want to make it clear, and maybe this will reassure John, I think the vast majority of prosecutors do turn over exculpatory material. Mm. But unfortunately, this is becoming all too common where material, not just recently and not just here in Missouri, but across the country, this is a national problem where we have a certain number of prosecutors who are not living up to their obligations, their professional obligations, sure. And this is causing a problem for our for our judicial system.
Ryan Ferguson was featured on a number of national news programs after his release and has expressed interest in moving to Florida. Meantime, Charles Erickson, the friend that took a plea bargain to testify against Ferguson, is still in prison. That's all the time we have to reflect on these top stories of the year in this show, but of course, there was a lot more that happened too. If you visit KBIA.org, you can find our archive of all of our past programs. A few of the other top stories we talked about this year, the impact the Supreme Court's DOMA ruling will have in Missouri, the Maryville rape case and sexual assault reporting in mid-Missouri, shows on the implementation of the Affordable Care Act in Missouri, and multiple shows addressing development and student housing in downtown Columbia. Thanks again for tuning in to this special year-end edition of Intersection. Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. Intersection is a broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Intersection is produced by Raymond Tungekar, Janet Saidi, and Ruben Stern. Travis McMillan is our technical director, with production assistance from Casey Morrell and Andrew Yost. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. And I'm Ryan Famuliner. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great week.